Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for July 25th, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And we've got three segments scheduled for tonight. First, I'm going to do a little talking about the reflections on the current disorder, which is a title that William F. Buckley used to use as a sort of free-floating title for any talk that he gave in the 1970s. So I think I'll steal Bill Buckley's idea, reflections on the current disorder. And then about 10 or 15 minutes after the hour, we'll speak with Ken Silverstein about a piece he wrote for the current issue of the American Prospect on the war for oil scenarios. Is the United States really after Afghanistan's resources? And Ken Silverstein has a rather skeptical response to that, and we'll hear why from him in a little bit. And then finally, at the bottom of the hour, slightly after, we'll hear from Ron Haydock and Ben Shepard, who are the editors of a new volume just published by Verso, From ACT UP to the WTO, Urban Protest and Community Building in an Era of Globalization, a collection of essays on social activism today, and this form and content of it. And just a programming note, a week from today, August 1st, I'm going to have Michael Hart, who is the co-author of the book Empire with Antonio Negri, a book that caused quite a big splash. And we'll talk to Michael Hart about the reaction to the book and also what, if anything, has changed in his view of things with the George Bush administration, the collapse of the Third Way, the return of American unilateralism, which somewhat contradicts the thesis of empire. So it's a week from today, about this time, we'll speak with Michael Hart. And Bill O'Reilly hosted The O'Reilly Factor on the Fox News Channel, which is one of the funniest shows on TV, and not always intentionally so, has a feature on every show called The Most Ridiculous Item of the Day. O'Reilly's politics are largely appalling, but he's entertaining, and I'm going to steal this idea and begin presenting a most ridiculous item of the week on this show. Here's the premiere. According to official capitalist ideology, CEOs and other top execs deserve their enormous salaries because they're big risk takers and because they contribute so much to society. It's pretty well established that executive pay actually bears little resemblance to performance, but here's an extreme case. Neil Travis reports in today's New York Post, that's my second citation in less than a minute of a Murdoch media property. I assure you this is entirely accidental. But Neil Travis reports in the Post that Bob Pittman, who has been squeezed out of a top job at the troubled media giant AOL Time Warner, is going to leave his office with a $60 million plus severance deal. Now, this is a company whose stock is off more than 80% over the last 2 years, off just over 20% just today. That's a decline twice as much as the overall market. And now AOL Time Warner is also, it was announced yesterday, under investigation by the SEC for accounting chicanery. If you get $60 million for being part of a colossal failure, what would the price tag be for success? But Pittman's parting check is nothing compared to that enjoyed by ex-CEO Gerald Levin, architect of the merger of AOL and Time Warner, a merger that is now universally regarded as a disaster. Levin left the company earlier this year with a more than $200 million parting shot. Nice work if you can get it. I was thinking about potential guests to discuss the stock market meltdown and the corporate scandals tonight, but I was overcome by an irresistible attack of vanity and concluded that I could do it better than just about anyone else. So here we go. First, a measure of the damage. As of Tuesday's closing prices, the most widely used benchmark for the stock market, the Standard & Poor's 500 Index, was off 48% from the high it made in March 2000. The S&P 500 is a broader measure than its more famous cousin, the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The Dow is made up of just 30 stocks, while the S&P, as its name suggests, is comprised of 500. That 48% decline is a hair behind the achievement of the last major bear market, that of 1973-1974. We're just a few tenths behind, a few tenths of a percentage point behind that decline, which was just over 48%. The NASDAQ now is off 76% from its March 2000 high. Both averages have a ways to go before matching the granddaddy of them all, the 1929-32 decline, which was 82% as measured by the S&P 500. But the 1973-1974 bear market was the worst since the 1930s, so we've pretty much matched that record, and I don't think that the bloodletting is over yet, despite yesterday's powerful rally and today's seesaw action. Indeed, it wouldn't surprise me to see the Dow tack on 500 or 1,000 points over the next weeks or months, but that wouldn't change the big picture very much. And what is that big picture? What does this all mean? As I've said here before, in normal times, the zigging and zagging of the stock market doesn't mean much to the outside world. Unless it's your job or your own money is on the line, stocks often inhabit a world of their own, with little impact on or relevance to the real economy. But we haven't seen normal times, at least as far as the stock market is concerned, since around 1996, when individuals started playing with stocks in a big way, and the stock market as a whole began escaping the Earth's gravitational field. To imagine what effects the bust might have, let's think back on the boom. A rising stock market can have several economic effects. One is direct. Strong markets encourage companies to go public, meaning that the small circle of original owners float shares in an initial public offering, or IPO. The proceeds of an IPO generally go towards cashing out the original investors, typically the founders and their earliest funders, like venture capitalists. And if there's some money left over, it goes towards investing in expanding the underlying business and hiring new workers. We saw a big gusher of this sort of thing in the late 1990s, though it's clear in retrospect that a lot of those businesses, like Pets.com, should never have been funded in the first place. But there are also indirect economic effects. A rising market encourages optimism, leading established businesses to invest and hire more than they would have otherwise, and inspiring stock-owning households to save less and to spend more than they would have otherwise. We saw lots of that, too, in the late 90s, as the personal savings rate in the U.S. declined near zero, the lowest level since the early 1930s, and as personal debt levels made new highs into the 2000 peak in the markets. So the rising market goosed the real economy to levels beyond what normally would have it would have managed, whether in normal times, whatever we mean by normal. There are more subtle effects, too. The bull market greatly raised the prestige of American capitalism around the world. Suddenly, other countries wanted to be more like us, which means with flexible labor markets and no welfare state. Flexible labor markets is the polite way to say no job security, no benefits, and low pay, unless, of course, you're Bob Pittman or Gerald Levin. Millions of people came to believe that the market could not only fund a comfortable life in the present, it could assure a comfy retirement in the future, especially since Social Security was certain to go broke. Social Security is not certain to go broke, but that's the myth. And people came to think that brilliant ideas and clever branding strategies produced value in themselves without needing the intervention of mortal human workers. And why did they believe that? Because the stock market said so. So let's throw all this into reverse. Falling markets mean very few IPOs, choking off funding for new businesses to expand and hire, and depressing what Keynes called the animal spirits of entrepreneurs, putting them in the mood for retrenchment, not fresh undertakings. Households who thought they were getting richer suddenly feel poorer, much poorer, and spend less and borrow less. This is prudent for individuals, yes, but not so good for an economy dependent upon high or excessive, even, levels of consumption. Workers who are close to retirement are now having to reevaluate their plans, and those who thought they could retire at 60 or 62 may find themselves working until they're 70 or older. Also, governments at all levels are experiencing much lower tax collections, in part because of economic weakness, but also because of the direct result of lower stock prices, lower capital gains realizations, and therefore lower tax obligations. And service cutbacks are inevitable. This is especially true here in New York City, where the economy has never been so dependent upon Wall Street. One bright spot, though, is that the global prestige of U.S. capitalism is taking severe hits, which is what it deserves. There are more subtle messages in the market's steep decline, too. As I've been saying here, it's extremely unusual for the stock market to fail to respond to the stimulus of lower interest rates that is engineered by the Federal Reserve Board. Normally, a generous Fed inspires strong stock markets, not once in a generation declines, but that's what we've gotten. The only precedent for this behavior is the 1930 to 31 period, when the Fed was actually less aggressively indulgent than it has been over the last year and a half. And though by most measures it looks like the recession ended last December or January, the stock market's not acting like it. This is the only post-World War II recovery in which the market has fallen rather than rising smartly. Why should this matter? For several reasons. The market does have a pretty good record of anticipating major turns in the economy. Not every squiggle, for sure, but major trends, yes. And there are several reasons for this. One is that the market is a measure of liquidity in the system. How much spare cash is floating around? If there isn't much spare cash, if it's all devoted to paying basic expenses and servicing debts, then the market may be weak as a result. But the market is also what pollsters call a feelings thermometer for the investing class, a measure of how flush and optimistic people with money feel. Since they're the ones who ultimately determine what's produced and how much and by whom, and if they're not feeling very good, the rest of us will feel those effects. When the stock market kept declining in the early 1930s, it was a sign that a deflationary depression was underway. I'm pretty confident that a collapse of that sort is impossible today. Government is just too big for the whole economy just to implode. But what we've seen in Japan over the last 10 years may be a taste of how a deflationary depression operates today, a long period of economic stagnation and increasing social stress. There's that possibility, or, for another precedent, there's the U.S. economy of the 1970s that followed upon the last great bear market. That was inflationary rather than deflationary, but it was also a time of high unemployment, falling real wages, and mass alienation. I don't know what form this bust is likely to take, but I'm pretty sure we've entered a period of economic troubles. For a decade, the U.S. economy chugged along while the rest of the world experienced stagnation or worse. I'm pretty sure that that phase of American exceptionalism is behind us. I don't know what's coming next, but it's probably not good, which is why it's essential for leftists or progressive or radicals or whatever we want to call ourselves to get out there and explain what happened to the public and organize against the austerity, crackdown, and reaction that generally accompany bad economic times. A final point. Many Wall Street types are talking about a disconnect between the market and the real economy. Yes, the real economy is doing a lot better than Wall Street is, at least for now. But they talk, the real economy is doing a lot better than Wall Street, at least for now. But they didn't talk like this on the way up. On the way up, a rising market was proof that everything American finance and industry did was right and great. Now we know that a lot of those heroic financiers and industrialists were crooks. And the falling market should be telling us that along with the crooks, there are a lot of hacks and incompetence lurking too. But the disconnect, Wall Street hopes, will save us. Related to the disconnect argument is another frequently on the lips or typing fingers of pundits. The U.S. is nothing like Japan of 10 years ago. Our economy is fundamentally stronger and more flexible, that word again, than theirs. And Japanese households were big savers. Other differences between the U.S. and Japan that are less flattering to the U.S. model. Japanese households were big savers, not borrowers. Today, U.S. households owe record amounts of money to their creditors. Japan, too, 10 years ago, and also today, was a giant creditor on the world scene. Today, the U.S. is a giant debtor. So these two are ways in which the U.S. is no Japan, though ways much less flattering to our egos. And let's revisit the late 1980s for a moment. Then it was a commonplace that the U.S. was washed up and Japan was poised to take over the world. That aura of invincibility turned out to be a byproduct of Japan's great speculative bubble. It may be that the notion of the fundamental greatness of the U.S. economy is the last surviving byproduct of our own bubble. We'll see. And we'll be back in just a moment after this message from the Gang of Four. Capital, it fails us now. Comrades, let us seize the time, said the Gang of Four about 22 years ago. And We read in the July 22 edition of the American Prospect, the war in Afghanistan is a sham. The Bush administration had advanced knowledge of the September 11 attacks, but it took no action. Using the assaults in the World Trade Center and the Pentagon as an excuse to topple the Taliban regime and legitimize the takeover of Afghanistan. Well-placed government insiders, knowing of the impending attacks, made fortunes by betting on a huge fall in airline stocks. The war is not about terrorism, but about America's desire to control energy in Central Asia and promote corporate plans to plunder the region's reserves. The chief U.S. concern all along has been to help Unocal Corporation build a pipeline across Afghanistan, which would carry natural gas from Turkmenistan to Pakistan. Certainly you've heard this, but our next guest, Ken Silverstein, who wrote those words, doesn't necessarily agree. Welcome to WBAI, Ken.
Thank you.
So what's wrong with all that, Ken? Why is that, that standard scenario, which many of our audience have probably heard many times and may even believe, why is it all wrong?
Well, where to begin? I mean, the war began for a very simple reason, because Al-Qaeda apparently decided to attack the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and kill thousands of people and commit fairly horrendous act of mass murder. So the idea that the war is about anything but terrorism or the war is about anything but those attacks is just plain stupid. And most stupid of all is the idea that, I'm sorry to say, I hear bandied about quite frequently, that the war is about oil and energy, and that somehow the United States was just so keen to take over Afghanistan. Afghanistan was so important, indeed almost a linchpin of Western civilization in terms of energy, that we just used it as an excuse to go in and take over Afghanistan. I would question why anyone would want to take over a country like Afghanistan. It's a complete mess. It has no natural resources. It has virtually no oil, virtually no natural gas. It's, you know, the conspiracy theorist, which is what it is, these theories that are bandied about are pure stupid conspiracy theories. They say that, you know, Afghanistan was this vital route for Caspian energy. And yet, there was a pipeline proposal by Unocal that died in 1998. Unocal, as of 1998, had no interest in pursuing this pipeline, which, by the way, I did point out in the piece, it was a natural gas pipeline, not an oil pipeline. Many of the conspiracy theorists don't even realize that, but it seems to me a fairly important distinction.
Yeah, oil, gas, you know, it's all hydrocarbons.
All the same thing, right. So, you know, in 1998, Unocal had dumped it. The Clinton administration had, you know, gone after these Al-Qaeda training camps. And from 98 on, the pipeline project was dead. So this ridiculous idea that's been popularized by the two French writers, Brissard, and I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Dusqui, I think is his name. They wrote the book Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth. This idea that somehow the administration, the Clinton administration, and then the Bushies were fixated on securing this vital pipeline route, it's almost too stupid to even debate. But unfortunately, it has to be debated because so many people continue to throw around this idea.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. There are a lot of people who say that the administration knew that something was going to happen and they just let it happen. You know, there are people who also said that Franklin Roosevelt knew that the Japanese were going to bomb Pearl Harbor in 1941 and let it happen just because they wanted the war. There are even more extreme versions that say that the CIA or Mossad or somebody even was behind these attacks, not Al-Qaeda. It was all just a pretext to launch this war for oil. What's your reaction just to this first premise that the obvious reasons for the war are actually a cover for a conspiracy so immense?
Well, it's really offensive and revolting and disgraceful. I mean, I would point out to people, you know, people say, well, how could the CIA not know? Of course they knew. I mean, the CIA, the Clinton administration learned that the Indian government had set up, had done nuclear testing when the Indian government announced it in a press release. I mean, the administration didn't even hear about it from the CIA. And so the idea that the CIA is all-powerful and can suss out any plot around the globe at will just strikes me as being ridiculous, and it's sad that people would believe that. And the whole idea that you would allow a terrorist organization to kill thousands of your own citizens and to bring down one of the most important symbols of your country, it's just too stupid. I mean, if you want to, I mean, it wouldn't be, the CIA, the U.S. government has at various times tried to create incidents. I mean, go back to the Gulf of Tonkin. Okay, they create an incident where American patrol boats were fired upon. That, to me, makes some sense. And it turned out, you know, I mean, it makes some sense in that, you know, there's not a real big collateral cost there. But the idea that you would allow people to bring down the World Trade Center and to fly a plane into the Pentagon and to kill thousands of people to legitimize the takeover of Afghanistan, which is not worth taking over and is just going to be an enormous burden and headache, I mean, it baffles me that people can believe this crap.
Now let's move on to the other part of the story, which is that Afghanistan, even if it has no resources in its own, is an important transit route for getting resources out of the Caspian region. And you know, the Caspian region does contain very large oil and gas deposits. That's not controversial. But what about the merits of moving some of that product out through Afghanistan?
The Caspian has enormous reserves. And the United States is already in a terribly comfortable position vis-a-vis the Caspian because we have good relationships with the regimes there. And we're going to get the oil. Well, first off, I should point out that although, again, the conspiracy theorists seem to believe that much of the Caspian energy reserves are headed to the United States, very little of those reserves will come here. It's mostly for South Asia, Europe, Russia. The United States is not going to directly exploit or use much of that energy. But the idea that we had to have Afghanistan to get at those reserves is just ludicrous. I mean, Afghanistan is not a smart place to build a pipeline of any sort. Unocal's project was considered to be something of a joke. It was scorned by most oil companies, energy companies, because they considered it a really dumb idea. Because you don't build a pipeline across a country like Afghanistan that has been in a state of war for decades and where it would be impossible to protect a pipeline across thousands of miles. I mean, it's a crazy idea. I mean, that, in fact, is why UNICAL looked upon the Taliban's coming to power as a positive thing, was because they thought they can bring stability, that terrible word, stability meaning they'll repress their people so severely that we might be able to actually run a pipeline across this crazy place and get gas out. But it's a really silly place to build a pipeline because a pipeline requires stability, and Afghanistan does not have any sort of stability. That's one point. Secondly, there are far better routes to build pipelines to get at the Caspian's reserves, and that's, in fact, what has been happening. There are a whole bunch of new pipelines that have been built in the last few years that are going to take out Caspian oil and natural gas. You don't need Afghanistan. I mean, it was maybe choice number three or four to begin with, and now it could conceivably think of building a pipeline across Afghanistan now for oil or natural gas. I mean, no company is going to put up billions of dollars now to do that, given the state of the country, the economic chaos, the political chaos, the fact that Afghanistan could easily fall back into anarchy. No one knows. But what corporation is going to invest $3 to $4 billion in a pipeline project across Afghanistan? You'd have to be completely insane. And in addition to that, as I said, there are a number of other projects that have come online that were in the planning stages before, that have subsequently come online, so that the Caspian reserves, you have an export, you have a surplus export capacity for both gas and oil right now. In a decade, at the earliest, you might see Afghanistan being bandied about again as a potential source, as a potential site for a pipeline, for a pipeline. But it probably won't even happen then. I mean, it would require Afghanistan turning into a much more stable country, and it would require, there's a terrible glut of natural gas on the world markets right now, particularly in South Asia, where the Caspian gas reserves were meant to, the reserves that were going to be pumped across Afghanistan, the natural gas. That was going to stay in Asia. India and Pakistan were going to get most of it. But things have changed. I mean, they have a glut of natural gas. So you need a whole bunch of things to happen for Afghanistan to possibly emerge as a site for a new pipeline. And even then, you'd have to have a very stable government and a very stable political situation for corporations to invest that kind of money. So, you know, I mean, this whole idea is just ludicrous.
Now, this is, as you point out, this is a line of thinking, though, with a rather long precedent. Back in 1980, as you say, following the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Carter administration and the press argued that the occupation had dramatically altered the world balance of power. To take but one example, Newsweek said at the time that control of Afghanistan had put the Russians within 350 miles of the Arabian Sea, the oil lifeline of the West and Japan. Soviet warplanes based in Afghanistan could cut that lifeline at will. Well, was that true?
Well, it was absolutely foolish. It's as foolish as the conspiracy theories now. And that's one of the great ironies, is that people on the left who are touting Afghanistan right now as this pivotal country in terms of Western oil needs and Western energy needs are as foolish as the Carter administration and the press was back in 1980. They're pushing the same silly line. I mean, at least the Carter administration had a reason to do it, to stoke up the Cold War. I mean, you know, the people on the left who are promoting this now do it out of sheer stupidity, which I think is even worse.
You said a piece that Peter Kahn, who's now the top guy at Dow Jones, he was a reporter then for the Wall Street Journal.
Peter Kahn, it was a piece, I think it was in, you know, I'm traveling and I don't have the story with me. I think the Wall Street Journal piece was back in 73, where Peter Kahn had written a piece saying, "Do the Russians covet Afghanistan? If so, it's hard to see why." And he described the place. Well, you know what, Doug? I'm going to have to ask you to say how he described the place, because I don't have the piece in front of me, but it's a pretty funny and apt description.
Yeah, he says, reporter Peter Kahn wrote that the great power strategists tend to think of Afghanistan as a kind of fulcrum upon which the world's balance of power tips. But from close up, Afghanistan tends to look less like a fulcrum or a domino or a stepping stone than like a vast expanse of desert with a few fly-ridden bazaars, a fair number of feuding tribes, and a lot of miserably poor people. And, you know, that's certainly more true now than it was 20, 25 years ago.
Certainly it is. And so the idea that you would be desperate to take over Afghanistan is just, I don't know. As I said, it just really baffles me that people can believe this sort of stuff. You know, the other thing that I have to say that I find striking is that for so many people, everything, American foreign policy revolves around nothing but oil and energy, and that's the explanation for everything. You know, if you go back a few years, you'll find that there were all sorts of theories about the war in Kosovo, that was all about Caspian oil, too. I mean, I think you'd come up with at least a better conspiracy theory, but instead we're just recycling the same old one. I mean, the war in the Balkans was about Caspian oil, and of course that panned out not, you know, that's completely foolish. It wasn't true, and I think it's quite obvious now it wasn't true for certain. I mean, if people believed it back then, I mean, there's no reason to believe it now. But now, once again, the whole thing is being revived. You know, I just think you need to have a fairly, a much more sophisticated analysis of what drives American foreign policy than to pin everything on oil or natural resources.
Yeah, I mean, there's little doubt that U.S. foreign policy is motivated by control of wealth and resources, but the oil explanation, you know, is just like kind of a lowest common denominator vulgar explanation of what imperial power is all about.
There's no question. I mean, this is not to suggest that the, you know, American foreign policy is based on humanitarianism and that, you know, I mean, I don't know of any country in the world whose foreign policy is based on humanitarianism. Most countries, in fact, I would say all countries act out of their own self-interest. And the United States certainly has a keen interest in securing energy reserves around the world. But to suggest that every time there's a war or every time there's some foreign policy crisis that it's all about oil is just foolish. So, you know, it's just this wonderfully simple explanation. But if anyone bothers to look at the history and the record to believe it, just requires tremendous ability to close one's mind to the real world.
I never quite understood, you know, these notions of getting control over the oil. I mean, if some bad guys got control of the oil, they'd still have to sell it to us. So it's like,
exactly. I mean, where are they going to sell the oil? You know, you're going to sell to countries that want to buy it. And again, in the case of the Caspian, most of that is not going to be bought by the United States, but certainly, as you say, if a bad guy takes over, Here's a perfect example. Who's the second biggest supplier of oil to the United States? Saddam Hussein. I mean, you sell to your buyers, and we are buying through, not directly, but through middlemen, an enormous quantity of Iraqi oil. So do we, I mean, there's another example of, is the war in Iraq all about oil? If the Bush administration goes into Iraq, is it purely about oil? I don't think so. We're already buying enormous quantities of oil from Saddam Hussein. Now, of course, oil is a huge driving force in our foreign policy, no question about it. But to sort of have this, you know, one-size-fits-all theory for American foreign policy, I just find, I've said it too many times. I just find it very, very incredible that people can believe this sort of stuff.
Well, in conclusion, though, what could you say about a political culture in which is so susceptible to these murky conspiratorial explanations and such, you know, sort of lowest common denominators of explanations of how imperial power works? I mean, what kind of culture produces this kind of thinking?
I think, unfortunately, a culture that is absolutely unwilling to engage in a debate and unwilling to consider any facts that don't fit with its own theory, and an unwillingness to study and learn, and an unwillingness to grow and to become to develop a more sophisticated analysis of the world. I mean, I get the feeling that people still view the world as if we were as if the Cold War was still going on. I mean, it just seems as if a lot of people who pour out this stuff haven't bothered to study anything or read anything, and certainly other than views that support what they already believe. It's really quite sad.
All right, we'll have to conclude on that sad note. Thanks for joining us, Ken Silverstein, and thanks for interrupting a vacation to join us, too.
Thank you very much.
And Ken Silverstein is an investigative journalist based in Washington, D.C., and author of this piece, which is on the American Prospects website, www.prospect.org. And the rest of the URL is too long to read over the air, but you can find it. Ken Silverstein, No War for Oil. And we'll be back in just a minute to talk with Ben Shepherd and Ron Haydick. That was the Gang of not the Gang of Four. That was the Mekons in that great song about conspiracy theories, Insignificance, from an album about 6-7 years ago. And I should say this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. And now we're joined in the studio by Ben Shepherd and Ron Haydick, although it says in the cover Benjamin Shepherd and Ronald Haydick. Editors of a book just published by Verso, which is trickling into the stores now, From ACT UP to the WTO, Urban Protest and Community Building in the Era of Globalization. And I'm guessing from the title, you don't mean to suggest that the WTO is some kind of global loose affinity group for the capitalist class. I mean, it's the protest against the WTO that
Absolutely.
You're referring to, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
Now, this book focuses a lot on ACT UP and Queer Nation and Lesbian Avengers and things like that, but groups that some sort of classic leftist thought of as suspect, that they were focused on, you know, lifestyle or identity issues, and that the mode of organization was suspect.
Very important, all those lifestyle issues.
But you're saying that this whole, you know, new generation of protest can be traced in some part to the ACT UP precedent. Could you trace out the argument?
Yeah, I'll take a start on that. I mean, but I think there was a long time there when activism seemed pretty dour, pretty serious, pretty much a series of competing oppressions. You had to sort of have a long consciousness-raising process before you could go to a demonstration and prove yourself. And ACT UP simply brought an immediacy there. I mean, there are lots of other groups, the feminist organizing in the 70s. I mean, we trace some of this to the Congress of Racial Equality in the 60s, of course. But there was just a simple point that people are dying and we've got to do something yesterday. And that brought an immediacy to activism that I hadn't felt before that. And it brought a flair, a certain sartorial splendor to activism that in fun sometimes that people hadn't seen. So, no, ACT UP isn't the most important group. There are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of groups, just like the WTO. There were lots and lots and lots and lots of protests before and after Seattle. But ACT UP was – there was a bellwether moment there, absolutely.
No, I believe one of the contributors points out that ACT UP's graphics were really snazzy. They're not your usual handwritten, you know, ugly signs that you used to see at demonstrations. These were, and they have one of the most famous logos of all time, very excellent logo.
Yep, so purple.
Yeah.
Triangle.
So, just how important is that image to what the argument you're trying to make?
Well, I mean, there's certain icons, and I'm going to shut up in a second. But I mean, yeah, silence, death. I mean, it's something we will remember from one of the great icons of the latter 20th century. But again, you had people who had a certain relationship to power, let's say that, you know, maybe had been working on Madison Avenue. I mean, it had a sense of social marketing, had a sense of marketing. And while, let's say in the anti-nukes movement, everybody would get their magic markers out and write no nukes, and there were flowers, and it looked fabulous. I love that stuff. My flyers look a lot like that. But that was another – there was a real media strategy behind ACT UP with some of those images, and nobody was apologizing for using marketing to make a point. I mean, lives had to be saved yesterday, so whatever was available, by any means necessary.
Really, it was about direct action, and the immediacy point is critical. And that does draw on, as we say, the roots of the Civil Rights Movement, which was certainly, in many respects, direct action-oriented. As Ben says, a lot of folks had to sort of cut their teeth on the left, of course, and there's many splintered groups that there are shards of of remnants of from that time to sort of prove your credential. But ACT UP really brought together groups who had previously not used what you're calling cultural tactics or icons or marketing techniques or, things that have traditionally been more mainstreamed, because the issues were so immediate, so critical, and people were being creative. Much of the movement, the social motion, and the winds from the 60s and 70s, had seemed to recede to some extent in the 80s. The backlash was pretty severe, and ACT UP was like a breath of fresh air. It was like opening up the newspaper on the day that the Zapatistas, burst onto the scene on New Year's Day and appropriated new modes of action for similar causes in some ways. That's part of the gist of the argument.
That's the voice of Ronald Hiduk, who is co-editor, along with Benjamin Shepard, who you heard a little earlier, from ACT UP to the WTO, Urban Protest and Community Building in the Era of Globalization, just published by Verso. It wasn't just the style of protest that was different about ACT UP. You mentioned the precedent of the civil rights movement and direct action, but a lot of the civil rights organizations of the 50s and 60s were organized kind of like traditional political parties and pressure groups. ACT UP was not. It was a very different kind of organization. So could you talk about what that meant?
You mean more decentralized?
Yeah, no hierarchical, spontaneous.
Well, the thing that ACT UP did was you didn't have to – there was no list of members. There were – as long as you wanted to do a Monday night ACT UP meeting, people all over the country could do them. There was no organizational infrastructure there. There was nobody was being paid to do this work. There was when people there have been occasionally arguments through the years. Maybe we should fund a few members of our organization to do some of this work. And ACT UP have always said no. That's not going to be part of our work. So you had an organization which was completely working outside of funding, federal funding, which seemed to create a backlash in the 70s. I mean, in, you know, Mobilization for Youth, lots of groups that had been paid to do community organizing in the late 60s. And, you know, there's a certain point you're going to defund these groups. A lot of these groups got defunded. You're not allowed to use federal money from the federal government to community organize against the, against your funder. That doesn't work. 15 years later, yeah, too bad. But as much as we try to do that, I would never do that myself. But 15 years later, there are still Monday night meetings going on all over the country. Leaders have died. Generations of leaders have died from ACT UP. There have been three presidents have retired since ACT UP started. And yet you can still go to the Gay Community Center and the Greenwich Village, and there's going to be an ACT UP meeting, and people are going to be yelling, and they're going to be talking about playing in action.
So then how did we get from ACT UP in the early, mid-80s to the Seattle in 1999? What were the intervening events that led to this political evolution?
Well, there were many, 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 many ones.
And, of course, if you buy the book, you can find out.
Yeah.
Just a little teaser.
The book has 40 authors that tell many of the tales, stories about actions that took place that were kind of under the radar screen throughout the late 80s and 90s, which we try to document in detail in the book. The authors, primarily participants in these direct actions. One that I'll speak about for a moment, just to give you a flavor, is an action that I took part in here in New York City in 1995. It was after Pataki was elected in 1994 and Giuliani in 1993, and a series of severe budget cuts were coming down that were hurting a variety of communities. And there was, you know, a lot of fragmentation on the left, more traditionally, and a bunch of groups. But there was a moment when, you know, there was a lot of a sense of aggrieved communities, you know, a lot of crap. I mean, Giuliani's sort of, you know, heavy-handed, you know, attack on squeegee men and all the rest was just sort of a precursor. But there was an attempt by a number of groups that came together, primarily ACT UP, people who were fighting racial oppression, led especially by the National Congress on Puerto Rican Rights, CUNY students who were facing severe budget cuts, and Union 1199 healthcare workers. And there was a moment when people came together and organized autonomous protests, but on the same day at the same time. And it was an interesting model where it was able to be decentralized, right? These four different sort of coalitions of groups that were that often don't find themselves in the same room, but see that their oppressions were linked. That, you know, healthcare, the lack of healthcare and affordable education and housing was totally linked to the oppression of people of color, and that if, you know, together, you know, maybe we could, you know, mount some opposition to the cuts that were coming down and
follow the money, right?
Follow the money, yeah. Get some of the money, and propose an alternative, mm-hmm. which is ultimately what the anti-globalization or global justice movement, we like to call it, really does propose. Here's what democracy looks like. Here's what an alternative would be. And on April the 25th at 5 o'clock in 1995, hundreds of protesters in different parts of the city, you know, this took months to organize, shut down the Brooklyn Bridge, the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, and another one that I'm forgetting, but right. Four of them, and said, you know, hey, this city is ours. We need things. We being these diverse groups, these we're representatives of the majority of the population in the city, in the metropolitan area. And, you know, these elites, obviously the politicians in question, but as your listeners well know, the dominant corporate actors and institutions that were undermining their quality of life. And Giuliani was reframing what quality of life meant, and we were trying to reappropriate that term and use it for proposing what a real democratic urban agenda that meets people's needs was all about, and do it through direct action.
Well, one of the interesting things about ACT UP is that traditional political activism was directed mainly towards lobbying the state. And ACT UP was focusing attention on private capital. Mm-hmm. And certainly you can see a lot of the so-called globalization, anti-globalization, whatever you want to call the thing, protests have been doing that too. I mean, we'll talk about that a bit.
Well, part of the story from ACT UP, from the formation of ACT UP in 1987 to the WTO in 1999 and going forward, it's 1,000 little actions, 1,000 little battles in an ongoing civil war against sort of corporate appropriation of private – of corporate privatization of public space. So – but part of the model, I think, that we're talking about, whether it's ACT UP or the mini groups that grew out of ACT UP between 1987 and 1999 is – identifying a very clear target, a very winnable target, mm-hmm. Doing specific, sophisticated media campaign, and using direct action. And it's sort of boom, boom, boom. And it was very much a sense. Mentioned money for people with HIV and AIDS, and said, over and over and over again in negotiations, we need this money, we need this money. Here's a report here shows that 9 out of 10 new cases of HIV and AIDS are people of color, and we need this money. And over and over and over again, we made this argument. We had to go up to Albany, and all 61 of us get arrested, drummers playing "This Is What Democracy Looks Like" as we got arrested, and lo and behold, the money reappeared in the state budget. We had to do the same thing with City Hall, using very creative, colorful costumes. I mean, Alinsky talks about the point. You've got to reinvent the engagement. You've got to reinvent the intervention, or else to keep it fresh. And you have to have small wins. There's lots and lots and lots of small wins. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're talking about. No, I mean, global capital is what it is. I think that we're having a conversation, about crony capitalism that a lot of global protesters have been talking about for a long time right now. So I think we're shifting a conversation.
And now our friends down the street even know this, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We're running low on time, so let's get to a couple of points here. One is that, ACT UP, you can see that people – it was a matter of life and death. So it was very understandable that people would stay dedicated to this cause, because a lot of the people who are involved face almost certain death very mm-hmm. soon. I believe one of the pieces in this volume is an interview with Sarah Schulman, where she points out that the Lesbian Avengers membership dropped off after a very – quick period of time, and she said it was the anarchist thing. It was hard to maintain interest. Can this mode of organization or quasi-organization be sustained over time if there is not that urgency of life and death? Or do you need some more formal structures like, traditional parties or unions to keep things going?
I don't think that Ron or I mean, I don't think we're making an argument that you don't need the street people and you don't need the people at the table as well as having people on the streets. And I think we're looking at both. And there are a lot of activists that are at the table, righteous activists at the table. But what helps make their work really viable is having people on the streets making noise. And I think that helps their negotiation constantly. We consistently hear that when you guys all got arrested, that made our card much easier. So in terms of the organizations, they come, they go. But it's a vast civil society and conversation that's unfolding. I mean, a lot of the groups we've worked in have faded out. Everybody takes a break for a while. Then a new group starts up, and it's pretty much the same people with two or three people that have disappeared and a few new people that started. And, instead of worrying about somebody disappearing, you're sort of calling and saying, hey, are you good? Do you need anything? It's sort of somehow along the road with activism, people stopped saying that one thing, racism was more important than economic issues as opposed to gender issues or sex issues. They started to all, I don't want to say overlap or blur, they're all really important, but it wasn't mutually exclusive. So there are going to be lots of culture groups that are going to unfold as a result of this, of this new activism. So individual groups will always come and go, but the cause doesn't. And I think I can't name a time in New York when it's really slowed down, can you?
No, and in fact, if you think of the immediacy question, the folks that are engaged in sweatshops, you know, that's a daily immediate situation. That the anti-sweatshop movement, which is huge and growing, and has won living wage struggles in hundreds of cities around the country as a response to, is a good example of, you know, how, you know, ACT UP is, and its immediacy and its issue has been linked to, you know, traditionally labor issues and labor groups.
The ACT UP campaign in South Africa around Coca-Cola, same kind of campaign. You know, going.
We've only got about a minute left, so let me just ask one more question. What has the permanent war mobilization, you know, the 50-year war done for this kind of activism?
The 50-year war. What do you mean?
That's what Dick Cheney and George Bush say. We're in a 50-year war against terrorism, so we're only... We've just begun.
Hey, we got through McCarthyism, you know. We're going to keep this thing going. I mean, I think people are already delinking that relationship, saying that terrorists and dissent are the same thing. I mean, we have to be vigilant and challenge these guys. Their legitimacy is crumbling in front of their eyes.
So. Yeah, in some ways it's brought people closer together in terms of knowing that they need to work together on issues more closely and effectively. And, you know, this is a huge challenge. It's pushed off the domestic agenda a bit, some of the issues, but, you know, people are pushing back, and that I don't think that's going to stop. I think the 50-year war will continue from our end as well.
All right, we have to end it there. Thank you both for joining us. That was Ronald Haydock, and who, along with Benjamin Shepherd, are the editors of From ACT UP to the WTO, Urban Protest and Community Building in an Era of Globalization, just published by Verso. And programming reminder again, I'll have a week from tonight, Michael Hart, the co-author of Empire, will be with us to talk about the reaction to that book and any new thinking he's had. And let's go out with this old classic as interpreted by Robert Wyatt. Stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. Till next week. Goodbye.
The old things they did in their glory.